Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. And by my side, as always, at least in heart and soul, is Steve.
Hello, John. Good to be here. So serious
Hey,
today
yeah. Hey,
on a
and
Friday.
we have Sean joining us, luckily, this week.
John, how's it going? What a crazy week.
Yeah. So much going on. 2021 keeps rolling on. And we're lucky to have as our guest this week the founder and CEO of Seamork, Hossein Azari. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sean, John, and Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Well, Seamork is a blockchain company. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it and what you guys are trying to do?
Sure. We have been focused on building a gateway to crypto and blockchain. There is a great deal of technology built on public blockchains, and it involves a lot of activities that ends up on these networks being recorded as data on these networks. We specialize in understanding the structure of that data, as well as organizing it, standardizing it, and making it available in two general forms of product. One is our B2B product that we work with in institutions, and we provide this data in bulk for their analysis or for their audit purposes, analytics. But we also recently have launched a B2C product that extends our platform to help the retail customer to be able to see what's happening with respect to their wallets and their addresses on the blockchain network.
Hossein, I think what you're doing is so interesting. And one trend that I've seen in this space is staking. So just as an overview for the audience, staking is basically a way to earn like basically interest on your crypto. What's your view, Hossein, on staking? Once you if you're bought into the crypto space, and you want to earn interest on your crypto, you want to hold it for a long period of time. Have you any thoughts on either what your company is doing to kind of address this trend, or thoughts in terms of how staking and earning interest on your crypto is going to grow?
Yeah, it's a fascinating trend. It's actually one of my favorite ones, probably top one even, because of the interest generation component of it. You talk to these multi-trillion dollar institutions that they are, for example, focused on a fixed income, right? And their work is basically taking cash and turn it into these interest-bearing instruments that would pay you some interest, and it will put the money into low interest, low risk work, basically. This staking is a brilliant reinvention of that on blockchain networks. So say you have some crypto and you want to put it to work on these networks and gain interest for it, you can do that. And that is built natively to most of these blockchains. And some of them are also developing more tools around it. And you don't bear a third party risk in terms of like even having losing control of your assets. You just basically delegate the staking part in some cases in some blockchains, and it just earns you interest. And the mechanism behind it is you were putting your money to work to basically make the network more secure. It's a fascinating idea. I see it as one of the principal components that will allow us to bring banking on blockchains, because that to me plays the role that fixed income plays in our basically traditional finance. In terms of like trends we see, we work with companies who are in the staking space. We have clients who buy the staking data. Like every time that basically a staking event happen, these information also ends up on the blockchain. And the companies who are doing this staking or doing analytics about staking, like what are the rates, what are the like periods, lockups, and all those things, they need the data. So they come to us, we help them with the data from the blockchain around this information. So we have clients on our B2B side with respect to staking. On the B2C side, it is one of the features on our roadmap to enable our user, if they have a certain crypto that's stakeable, to stake it through our product and be able to gain interest for their crypto holdings.
That's amazing. And do you think that with this sort of like this staking trend, which is basically like, I'm going to give you my crypto, you hold on to it, I'll earn interest on it. Do you think with this trend, do you think the market will, you know, stabilize, it'll promote less volatility because people are actually storing their crypto more?
It definitely helps with a market being more stable, because there is some sort of a lockup period. When you stake, you might, like, the different platforms have different timelines, but you might not be able to even take your money back if you change your mind for a certain period of time. That definitely stabilizes the network more. In some networks, you don't even need to give custody of your assets. You just basically delegate a certain power to another entity to stake it for you, and you still have the custody of your assets, which makes it even easier. There is also there's a stability through the assets being locked up, as you brought up. There's also security of the network, because the more, you know, it has a name on it. The more people stake their money on keeping the network safe, the more interested they are in network, you know, staying safe. So that basically aligns interests of people to maintain a secure network.
So I haven't really heard a lot about the staking up to this point. So you're just setting aside your, it could be any cryptocurrency, and they kind of convert that volatility into some kind of a interest rate return.
It is structurally basically what you said. So in order to kind of put the full context, we need to go back to proof of work and how Bitcoin started as a decentralized platform. So basically, there's a fundamental problem in who gets to call the next block in a decentralized platform, especially starting from Bitcoin. And the way that the original paper and the current blockchain software solves this is the miners on the network or any computer tries to solve a problem, basically a reverse hash problem, and find a certain answer that will, if you have that, you can publish the next block and network will accept it. And whoever finds that faster, they get to publish the next block, which you get rewarded for publishing. So there is a big competition between miners, among the miners, to solve this problem and issue the next block. That obviously leads to all these mining operations that they also consume electricity, and it's all, you know, all over the news, the discussions about its carbon footprint and et cetera. So, but at the end of the day, proof of work, which supports Bitcoin, is one way to approach to solving basically the problem of who gets to issue the next block. There are other proposals and many other actually ways of thinking about this. A major way of thinking about this is staking. And the mechanism in this, but high-level mechanism is that you get to call the next block, but you need to have a skin in the game, in a sense that if you made a mistake, or if there was basically you tried to like do something and which is not correct according to the network, then you get to lose what you staked, or you get to be penalized.
Oh, and so, that's what keeps people honest, because it's exactly. Not just anybody can just throw in anything. It's people with something to lose. And that's where the staking name comes from then.
Exactly. And that's okay, how it makes it more secure, because now people who are saying what's going on the network actually have their basically money staked for it.
And then your company provides the data that everybody's looking for. How did you find the need for this, for what Seamork does?
That's a great question. So the data is basically public on these blockchains, just the same way as the data on the internet is public. But it doesn't mean it is easy to access. So if you think about what Google has done as like its search engine to the internet, is they organize basically publicly available data, but in a way that it is easy to use, it is kind of super fast to find what you're looking for. So we think similarly. So there's a lot of data that is being generated because of the activities on the blockchain. And as these blockchains grow, as the activities go up, the amount of this data goes up. So this data is public, but not organized or standardized. So we take that role to standardize and organize this data and make it easy to access. So we follow basically similar thoughts around how Googles of the world have helped with the internet. And when we started basically building these databases, we had demand from the early days. So because if you're building something on the blockchain, you have a commercial purpose. Like either you are a staking company that's trying to make money from fees that you stake, or you are an exchange trying to make money from the exchange activities. You are not focused on going and organizing and cleaning up this type of data. So you're focused on your commercial purpose. So you prefer to use a service to provide this data for you, to do the kind of dirty work of dealing with these platforms. And the costs of dealing with this is also high. So when we do it once, we sell it to multiple customers. It becomes meaningful for us. But if you want to do it internally all yourself, then you end up bearing a large amount of costs. Now, on top of all these, there's also some regulatory thinking around basically having this data to come from an independent source, because this is basically the ledger of your transactions and the ledger of your reserves. So if your own company is coming up with the ledger that your own company needs to like maintain, you have a bigger potential risk of making a mistake and just replicating that mistake all over your books. But that makes you to want to have an independent source of data also to cross-check with your own stuff.
You're going to get more and more attention from some regulators then, as more and more people point to you as the source for this data. Who's involved with you now, and who are you afraid will start to look at you?
So we are actually interested in regulators being more careful and cautious about where this data comes from and how this data is generated. So there's a fundamental change here. So in traditional finance or any other application, when you have some money somewhere, there is an entity you can write a letter and request the balances, right? Either if your stock is held by Morgan Stanley or your cash is held by JP Morgan, there's always these entities. You can go, or anybody else can go and say, "Hey, I want to know if so and so, who says they have like this much money, do they have it?" And you can get a letter from a third party confirming that. So with the blockchain, such a thing doesn't exist. So nobody has the centralized authority to say, "Hey, I know X has this many Bitcoins." So, but everybody has the data, it is out there. But there's nobody you can write a letter to. So that basically is a fundamental difference in the new world of blockchain, public blockchains versus the traditional finance. So that prompts the need for an entity that independently takes this data and allows you to go and look, confirm, if somebody was saying they have this much, if they actually have it. So that's why we think that when you, the more you have like regulatory thinking around these books being correct and trying to avoid mistakes to replicate through the system, you need an independent third party verifiable data source.
So you get to become another trusted third party vendor for all of your partners.
Correct.
That's not a bad place to be.
It is the early days, but as these platforms grow, there will be a bigger and bigger need for that third party.
So fascinating that you mentioned some of the insights that you could extrapolate for the companies that you work with. Anything you can share in terms of insights that the blockchain data has provided your businesses and any sort of use cases that can help us understand the power of that data?
Sure. We don't specifically ourselves get into extracting insights or labeling the data as like some of the companies in this space are focused and specialized on. However, we work with different companies. Some segments to mention is like exchanges. We work with analytics companies. We work with, for example, staking companies. So in the case of exchanges, they have this basically notion of internal controls. So they are doing all these trades on blockchain. They run their own nodes. And every time you run a node, you are connecting to the network. You are pulling the data. You are doing all these transactions. So an exchange is not strange to running nodes. They, in fact, run actually many nodes and maintain those and pull the data. However, when the books are kind of being compiled and like maybe their regular checks that goes over and says, okay, we had this many Bitcoins, we had this many trades, now we should have this many Bitcoins. They are doing that with their own data, but they also need to do that with an independent source of data to make sure those match. So exchanges use us as that independent source because if they made a mistake internally, or maybe even we made a mistake internally, these two will decrease the likelihood of failure. So in that case, the insight would be understanding that if there is a difference in keeping track of transactions, and there has been in some cases, we have noticed in some of the platforms, they are actually inherent mistakes have either historically made been made or actually continues being made that throws off the balances, right? If for a basically transactional ledger, you don't have the, you know, the two sides being balanced, it really loses its purpose. So we have noticed such problems. We have discussed it with the platforms and there have been fixes around those. So that is on just one use case of bookkeeping, let's say.
Fascinating context on that, Hussein. So it sounds like you guys really, you provide the data, but you're not doing as much of the insights. That's more on the business side.
Correct. And that's like our basically application agnostic approach. We want to be the data layer that is used by multiple different segments. And often each business has their own way of going and slicing and dicing this data.
Got it.
Interesting. Yeah. I heard it being described as basically Plaid for blockchain, which sort of makes sense, right? You're looking to create a single source of truth or in sort of blockchain data, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that gets me really excited. I'm very kind of amazed by the like platforms like Plaid, what they have done to like for the financial system and for so many applications that were able to build on top of their backend, the backend that they provide as a service. And if you think about it, they have driven the innovation, right? If every company who built on top of Plaid needed to go build those stuff themselves, we wouldn't have as many as successful companies out there. So it's super exciting to see companies like Plaid succeed the way they have. And it is a model that I really like.
Well, you seem to find some very interesting opportunities. You went from working at Google as a research scientist and then founding Clarity Money. How did that happen? And How is it compared to starting this company now, Seamwork?
Well, I have some recollection of all these events. It was like 5-6 years ago.
A lifetime ago, huh?
You kind of reimagine and rewrite it in your mind. But the documents and stuff that I have from my Google times is I was pretty active. I was trying to like find what's the next big project to be part of. And Google is just an amazing company that you can do stuff. Like they would let you to go try, like come up with crazy things, propose it to people. So I went basically far and I said, like, we have this concept of assistant. Why not to have a financial assistant and that helps people with their finances? I myself at the time was paid well at Google. I was just learning how to invest, how to save, how to spend. And I didn't have a place to really learn these from. I would just go around and like every now and then learn something interesting that was very insightful about like how do you deal with your money. And I thought like, well, Google can build a financial assistant as well. And you can ask Google questions. You can even try to like let Google to handle some of your stuff. And I went around, I proposed it. Long story short, I didn't get the, you know, feeling that it's something that I would be kind of, I would make more progress pursuing inside the company versus like, you know, going up my own way, taking more risk and doing it on my own risk, on my own terms, in a sense. So I think that was the source of it. And the reason that I got super interested in fintech in general and consumer finance was just looked at the technology scene. And the advertisement is the big money maker. Everything is basically beaten to death. Every type of business you can think about, they're like these gigantic companies doing these gigantic things. So there is a lot of things, obviously, to innovate on. But it is not the green field you can think of. You know, that an entrepreneur of young age who is just learning this stuff would get super excited about. So I have always had a drive toward, where is the like bleeding edge of technology that has a chance to do some good? And I think that was driving me toward consumer finance and fintech. And that also got me to like to go to Colombia to actually kind of closely like, you know, learn from folks who have been working or working in the finance industry to kind of fill in all the blanks that I had about everything finance. And it took me a couple of years from basically coming out of Google, doing the startup. It took me a couple of years to like really get a good sense of what I'm doing, what I'm trying to get to with the like the, where is the bleeding edge of technology that I think I want to spend my time on. And I think that was the general story or the way that I see it today.
The way you see it today, it'll change next year maybe. But well, Clarity did really well right from the start, yeah?
Clarity was, it was a great company. It had great service and value. When you put some value that customers have been looking to find for a while and didn't have options, you see the response. It is basically putting the right product out there and market response to the products. And that's what happened, I think, exactly with Clarity.
Yeah, great. So how did you feel? Now, Goldman Sachs ended up buying Clarity. What was your first reaction when they proposed purchasing or when you knew the deal was going to happen for sure? What was your reaction?
Well, Goldman Sachs is obviously one of the financial firms that have not had actually consumer focus, and they started Marcus, probably around 2015 or 16, if I'm not wrong, as well. And they started basically products that, with sharing a lot of the general thoughts around, we want to serve the customer, we want to work for the customer. So They have been trying to obviously build in a different approach and different brand than how consumer has been generally treated. It makes sense when you think about, well, for a big company who wants to make basically a quick dent in some vertical, to look around, see what are the winning horses and bet on them. And they had multiple other acquisitions on different aspects of what they have been building, and Clarity was one of them.
So you're thinking they wanted the best possible product out there, and so of course they're going to want to buy my company.
Well, that's encouraging, just, right?
Yeah.
So Sin, you actually were the chief data scientist at Clarity, which, you know, from my recollection of the space, of the PFM space, you know, 3-4 years ago, had a lot of, as the name implies, a lot of really interesting insights into how people were using their money or not using their money well. Is there anything that stands out as a kind of a life lesson that you learned by looking at Clarity data of its users?
Oh, well, I mean, I haven't thought about the question this way. I can probably talk 2 hours about like what I have learned from just the experience and the data. And obviously I was one of those users, right? I was building the product, or like being one of the first users. And I was in this stage that as well, that I needed to learn about money, even though I knew a lot about data science, but I never sat down with my own transactions and tried to write an algorithm on it. I think the big learning was around how all these transactional, how big of the part of the finance is all these transactional events. So when you think about finance, often you are thinking about like investment and you're thinking about these big deals, but most of what's happening in, like, especially in personal finance, is all these like little decisions you make, right? If it is just one mortgage decision or one big, you know, even a student loan decision, those are like something that you are going to call your parents, you're going to call some people, you are going to make a smarter decision inherently, because they are just once in a lifetime or multiple times in a lifetime, but not every day. I think the big part of, you know, the irrational behavior and not getting the best deal happens on the like high frequency small things we do. And often, like, I still make that kind of mistake. Like, you like buy something for $15. Okay, it's $15. So be it, right? Or you have recurring charges, goes one more month, or like it is just happening, you know, behind the picture, but you are not making the call to, like, to kind of wait there for 20 minutes to cancel it, because it's like $5 a month. So you don't have that chance. So if you think about all those little things, that is what hurts the customer, right? And consumer. So, and that's where you can innovate, where you can come up with algorithmic approaches to identify those behaviors, to tell people, hey, this is what's happening to you. First of all, be aware of it, but also do something to avoid it if you can.
So this is an issue that I've come across also in my day job as well, is that a lot of the people who are actually building these products, either as product managers or designers or even behavioral economists, sort of don't have the same economic profile as the end users, right? So I was involved in a project where we were creating basically a neobank for, you know, for lower income folks, and nobody in the team was actually lower income. We all made six figures, living coastal lives, you know, well-educated. Do you think that disconnect could lead to some not great outcomes for users? Or do you find that doing things like user testing and panels and finding way to do ethnographic studies on the potential users could fill that gap?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just let's compare a panel with, like, if you are the user, right? A panel, it gives you like maybe 10, 15 minutes of view, or like a user testing, 10, 15 minutes of view into one user who you just brought them in, like, with a lot of, you know, other effects in there. So compare that with somebody who is using the product for like 10 hours a day, or like exposed to the product for 10 hours a day, and trying to build for themselves, right? So that it's just much more powerful to be the user yourself. I would even go further to say, look, I mean, when you are building a product, like when a 20 years old is writing code, building and reimagining an app or future of finance, they are really building it for themselves. They have no idea what they are building, what they are going into. Like, what most of them, they don't know what mortgages they are. Most of them, they are not yet familiar with the details of all these things. They are just building very enthusiastic because they're imagining this is how the future is going to be for them. That's what they know. But once you have gone through those, right, and the more you are kind of not even going to use those products yourself, I think you also become less, you just care less, right? And you become less innovative because of that. Obviously, there are people that, you know, they are super creative, and they would be very innovative even when they are like, I don't know, it's time for them to retire. But if I'm thinking about a product for the future, I would rather a 20 years old build it than someone else.
Add confetti to the trade. That'll help.
Hossein, I think you hit on an interesting point that's sort of a pattern that we've been seeing on the podcast over the past few months, which is really a kind of re-energized, focused on retail. So as you mentioned, you know, Marcus by Goldman Sachs is kind of capitalizing on that trend, but also a lot of fast growth startups like Affirm and similar sort of companies that are giving the retail user a really interesting insight into their spending habits and how to manage their money better. How do you view the future of retail-focused finance? Do you think we continue on this trend, or do you think it may be premature? We'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I try to think about that probably almost every day. And the reason for that is, like, you cannot reimagine future without knowing, like, who are the, like, what happens or who are the users of that future. So, and the 20-something year old is doing things very differently, right? And we see all these trends now with GameStop, Robinhood, all the retail stock traders. So there is just this whole new way of doing things that is going to become the way of doing things in like 5-10 years as these new users or up and coming users will have more money, will have more attention to financial products, and that cannot be ignored. How do we try to like understand that, and how do we try to build around it is a great question. Another trend that is super interesting is the age is also being compressed. I mean, I've heard this, like, this youthification, which I think is real. So basically, you at the at your age, you are younger than your parents at your age. So the whole technology has made people to have a very kind of younger style, even if their ages are high. So higher than what you would consider young. And that is also another trend. So which if you don't consider, you would even be missing on the current market, who has obviously a lot of money to invest or do financial transactions with.
It's interesting. I've seen actually memes that kind of references, right, where they show, where people are now, say, at 35, and where their parents were at 35, they had, you know, three kids and a mortgage and a career and everything else. And nowadays, 35-year-olds are just sort of, you know, kind of coasting through life and just sort of finding themselves still and living in a post-adolescent kind of thing.
YOLO. Yeah, it's interesting. YOLO, Steve.
Yeah, it's all about the YOLO, yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for your inviting me. It was a very exciting discussion.
That's Hossein Azari, the founder and CEO of CMORQ. That's C-M-O-R-Q, by the way. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.